Yes, I'm joined by Dennis Stewart, and I'm glad he's doing most of the talking today. Hi, Dennis. I'm having a shocker. Lovely to see you. Now, Dennis, last week you discussed the role of herbs in helping female infertility.
Yes.
You explained how herbal medicine was a complementary system useful in addressing infertility conditions that have not sort of responded to medical treatment. Today you want to conclude your discussion by explaining how herbs work in helping infertility and then discuss herbs in helping other female reproductive problems. Would you like to elaborate?
I think I would. I'll take some of the talking load away from you, my dear. Although you always sound well.
Oh, thank you. Hard to get my words out sometimes.
You underestimate yourself, Amanda.
Thank you. Look, I'll keep you around all the time. Thanks, Dennis.
I took up that topic last week because even though I've taken it up in the past, it always causes considerable interest on the part of listeners, as evidenced by the number of people that contact my rooms at New Lambton or come and see me about the problem. Basically, what I was trying to say last week was that in a very common condition, more common than what most people think, that is the inability of many women in particular to be able to fall pregnant. And in this context, I presented what I have found to be very, very truthful, and that is that where the mainstream medical approach has not been successful, in many cases subsequently, but not always, women who have accessed what I call complementary medicine, which involves, in the case of female infertility, the application of particular herbs from the Western tradition in particular, which very, very often precipitate a pregnancy. Now, for the sceptics that might question that, please don't question it, because after 50 years in practice, I can validate the fact or my claim that the use of herbs in addressing female infertility that has not responded to the excellent approach of modern Western medicine, in many of those cases, fertility has been achieved. Now, that always raises the issue of, is it a system that is on its own, stands alone? I emphasised last week, and I will emphasise it again today, that the approach of using herbs in particular in addressing this problem should not be seen as a primary therapy. I presented my approach as being complementary, that is, a system to complement mainstream medicine and a system to use in the context of failed medical approaches, not a standalone. This is not an alternative as such to the mainstream medical approach, which is very, very successful in many cases. It is what's called complementary, that is, working alongside of, sometimes in place of. I needed to emphasise that in order to put it in its context. But there are still some people who say, well, look, if this is so, what is the explanation behind the action of these herbs? I'll touch on that briefly today in trying to explain how some of these herbs that I've used for very, very many years and studied them over many, many years can support the claim that they have a basis in helping women who have an infertility problem. I'll take that topic up and then we'll have a look at some of the other herbs that are also used in addressing female reproductive problems and female health problems generally. An interesting day. We probably won't get through it all, Amanda.
Well, it's an interesting topic. We will. We'll do our best, but hopefully we'll get some calls and people will be asking lots of questions about this topic or other topics. If you've got a health-related issue, you can give us a call. We're talking about infertility today, but before that, we've got John from Singleton on the line. Hi, John. You want to talk about psoriasis?
Yes, please.
Well, hello, John.
Hi, Dennis. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed. Is it cold up there this morning, John?
It's been fresh, but we have no frost yet, which is unusual.
Yes, yes, it is. I agree with you. It's surprised me how green it still is round the Hunter.
Yes.
Never mind. How can we help you, John?
Mate, I've got psoriasis.
Yes, psoriasis, yes.
And is that a something that can be got rid of, or is that something that you have forever?
Okay. What I would say about that is it's a, well, for the sake of listeners, I would just mention that psoriasis is a skin condition which is usually of a chronic nature and targets joints such as the elbows and the knees, usually as a fairly early sign of the condition. But psoriasis, a dry, scaly, flaky skin condition, can in fact affect the whole of the body, and it typically expresses itself in areas other than those joints on the head. But it can also affect the trunk, and indeed is probably one of the most chronic skin conditions to treat and one of the most difficult, I would say. Now, having said that, I would suspect that you have had it for some time and have been treated dermatologically with various medications, both topically and also perhaps by way of medication. Is that your situation, John?
Dennis, I have a spray that's all I've used. I think it's called something like Clavitane or something like that.
Yes. So you're spraying it on the joints or on your body?
Dennis, mine are mainly around the calves.
Yes.
And the shins.
Yes, okay. Look, it
and
can
think.
Yep. It can occur anywhere. You've had it for a fair while?
For 6 months.
Only 6 months. That's a fairly short period of time to have it. The first question I would ask is it responding to what you are topically doing?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
As you know, this stuff itches like crazy when you upset it.
Okay. And yours is characterised by itch, is it?
Yes, it is.
And it's definitely been separated from dermatitis or eczema?
Yes, I've been to a doctor and he said, mate, that's psoriasis.
Okay. Look, if it is restricted to those areas and it's not active elsewhere, that's what I would consider a useful area of the body to treat initially because it's restricted there and so early in its history. I would think using topical preparations is useful, and your good doctor has probably got you on a modern medication for it, and if it is helping, well and good. What I would say, however, is in my experience, I have found that two substances, particularly working together, are frequently very useful, particularly addressing localised areas. The first preparation or the first suggestion, and you can run this past your doctor or pharmacist, a preparation containing pine tar as a topical application in an aqueous zinc preparation is sometimes particularly useful in addressing the itch as well as the flakiness and dryness of the condition. That can be turned into or made into a cream. Now, a substance that's not so well known, but I had a lot to do in reviving its interest here in Australia, is a substance known as glycyrrhetinic acid. I'll not try to spell it to you on the phone because I'll get lost and so will you. But just write GA, glycyrrhetinic acid. It is an extract from the herb licorice. Now, when that is made into a cream or an ointment with some zinc, again, it is one of the most successful preparations that I have used in addressing topically the early stages of the condition. Blend that. I'm mentioning this because your pharmacist would know more than perhaps your GP on this. I'm not saying that disrespectfully, but blending some glycyrrhetinic acid with something like pine tar in an aqueous zinc cream, in my opinion, is still an undiscovered alternative to some of the more stronger and perhaps problematical topical applications. Mention that to both your doctor and your pharmacist. If you were to want more information on it, I'd be happy to forward it to you or your pharmacist or your doctor. The history and successful preparation that it is in addressing localised early stages of psoriasis.
Right. So I go to my doctor on Friday.
Yes.
9:10 And yep. So I ask for GA cream.
Yes.
Blended with pine tar.
Well, GA cream is excellent when blended with pine tar in a well-known formulation that's in some of the older editions of the British Pharmaceutical Codex, and that was popularly used in the United Kingdom for many years and is called up in some of the older dermatology journals. I discovered it probably 30 or 40 years ago and began to have it made up by a local pharmacist for me in Gosford. It proved to be very, very successful, particularly...
So your pharmacy can make this, Dennis?
He can make it if he can access the what you'd call the actives, that is, yep, getting hold of the glycoretinic acid and the and a bit of zinc that goes with it and the pine tar. If he can access that, the starting material for it... his pharmacy training, in my opinion, would allow him to easily convert it into a topical application, not necessarily in place of what your good doctor has prescribed, but perhaps something for your doctor to consider and your pharmacist also to consider. Because for many years, I've had patients accessing my clinic mainly to try that preparation. But always, I say on this program, seek out the things that I talk about from your own local pharmacy, doctor, or health food store. But that is a cracker of a formulation, which is well-based and well-proven and well-written up in the journals that the pharmacist and the doctor would have access to if they were interested.
Good luck with that, John. Hopefully you can get some relief with the psoriasis.
So do I.
Yeah.
I don't know how to spell it.
have a great day. Thanks for calling. And we have Sharon from Curry Curry on the line. Hi, Sharon. How can we help you today?
I'd like to give Dennis a compliment.
Go for it.
Well, hello, Sharon.
I'd just like to say, Dennis, that it's wonderful to hear someone advocating the use of lyaluronic acid. I've got it wrong. And pine tar. My father was struck with psoriasis 70 years ago.
Yes.
And in the old British Codex, that was what the treatment was.
How about that?
Yep. And he was absolutely covered in psoriasis.
Yes.
I used to put him in a pine tar bath.
Yes, good old pine tar.
And then they would smother him with the... GA.
Yes.
And he was able to cope with his flaking and sometimes weeping psoriasis.
Yes.
For the rest of his life. And he died at 75 and he was prescribed at 25.
How about that? How about that? So you early used the benefit of pine tar and the glycoretinic acid.
That's right.
And that was from a local specialist or doctor, Sharon?
Yes. We came from England.
I thought so. I thought so, because that combination was being used by British dermatologists, and I actually have some of the material that was written up in the British journal called Dermatology.
Yes.
And I'm not surprised, therefore, that your son or whoever it was benefited from that approach. I'll just let you in on a secret. Well, it's not a secret, but I don't talk about it frequently. One of the factors that actually encouraged me to pursue an interest in complementary medicine was associated with my own very serious experience of an associated condition called eczema.
Yes.
And it was so aggressive that it virtually took control of my skin.
Oh,
and I can well remember accessing the pine tassel or pine tar preparations and making a bath of pine tar in appropriate solution and soaking myself in it in order to get incredible relief from it, as particularly as far as the itch was concerned, and then use an appropriate ointment, which I later developed and called the GA cream or the GA complex cream. But I lament the fact, Sharon, that some of the older approaches are not as popular as some of the newer approaches, and I'm not knocking the newer approaches, but some of the old approaches that I have used and read well about, particularly those that seemingly were more popular in the United Kingdom, which I refer to still as the old country, that they didn't or have not seemed to be prominently used here. Mm-hmm. I would like to see those approaches, the anti-itch characteristics of various pine tar preparations and the healing anti-inflammatory benefits of licorice extract or glycyrrhetinic acid. So I commend you for your interest in that, and I thank you for mentioning it to confirm what I have done. Frequently listeners, not many, but frequently some listeners would think that I go over the top a bit. I hope I don't, but with reference to the skin, I think I know a bit as a result of my own experience of a very serious level of eczema, and for which those two substances have helped me and subsequently many of my listeners. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you very much. Love your program.
Thank you.
And many to come.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye, Sharon. And we've got Danny from Fingal Bay on the line. Thanks for holding, Danny. How can we help you?
Just an inquiry regarding something I can use for fatty liver.
Yes. Danny, could I ask you a few questions at this stage?
Yep.
How long have you had the diagnosis?
I've been treated for it for quite a few years, probably, Dennis.
Okay. What are called your liver enzymes? Are they stable, or what's happening there?
They started to go up in the last couple of months. They've started to increase.
Okay. Now, are you on any medication at all, or any treatment
I am.
At all? Okay.
I'm on blood pressure medication.
Yes. Yes.
Cholesterol.
Yes.
All of that sort of stuff.
Okay. Look, Danny, what I would say here is, from a herbal medicine perspective, there is one herb in particular, and you probably have heard of it, but may not be using it. It is the herb called St. Mary's Thistle, which is also in some literature called up as milk thistle. Now, don't confuse what we call milk thistle in this country with the herb St. Mary's Thistle. That is a name more popularly used for it, that is milk thistle, more popularly used for it in England and Europe. The name is common for the herb, St. Mary's Thistle and milk thistle. Botanically, it is known as psyllium, or what I call psyllium, S-I-L-Y-B-U-M, psyllium marianum. Now, that herb grows here in plague proportions and is easily identified, but because the herb is so well known around the world, particularly in Europe, and I emphasise particularly in Europe, from which, by the way, a lot of very sound and proven herbal medicine is developed, in Europe, the herb St. Mary's Thistle would be a herb that would be certainly prescribed to assist in stabilising the condition, which could be evidenced by a stabilising condition occurring, which would see, hopefully, your liver enzymes retreat or remain where they are rather than keep going up. Now, my reference here to support all of that would be the excellent work that listeners would have heard me talk about on this program, the excellent work simply entitled Herbal Medicine. And now, the herbal medicine is the English language terminology for the book. written by the well-known German doctor and brilliant medical herbalist. He was so magnificent that I have used his book entitled Herbal Medicine all my lecturing career. Dr. Rudolf Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, is the writer, and in that book, dealing with liver conditions, it is mentioned that the herb St. Mary's thistle is useful even for the treating of fatty liver. Now, okay. it is a herb that is very, very safe. Some herbs aren't that safe and should only be prescribed by a qualified herbalist, but this herb is so safe that it is difficult to see it interacting adversely with any of the medicine your good doctor has prescribed for you. Yep. And it is something that can show its potential, usually in a very short period of time. And you should discuss your taking of the herb St. Mary's thistle with your doctor. If he hasn't heard of it or read much about it, he should. Many doctors are becoming familiar with the literature and the provings associated with herbal medicine, and it would not be difficult for your doctor, even your specialist, if necessary, to Google or otherwise read the literature on St. Yep. Mary's thistle to see its what I would call profound reputation. It is the herb that I loosely refer to as being useful for most liver conditions, and in particular for fatty liver. Based on the support I get from Dr. Rudolf Weiss, I would suggest you discuss that. It's easily accessed. It's not expensive. You would be able to procure it easily from your pharmacist or your health food store. But in doing so, make sure you have what I would refer to as a standardised preparation, that is a preparation that has the necessary level of the herb in the preparation you're using. I would be very confident, that there should be some emerging evidence of stabilisation of your fatty liver condition if you were to add that as a supplement to what you're doing. Now, I must preface everything by saying that is my opinion. But I have vouched for the benefit of this herb since giving the first lectures on it many years ago. There's a history of that. I could go on talking about this herb forever, but there's a history of this. It was not a popular herb used in English-speaking herbalism. It occurred mainly in the European literature. I read widely on it, and as far as I'm aware, was one of the first to introduce it into the Anglo-American system of herbalism that dominated this system that we practice today about 50 years ago. I gave the first lectures on it, began to use it, and proved the benefits of it.
Okay. All right. We'll give it a go, Dennis, and see what happens.
See what happens, Danny.
Good luck, Danny.
Okay.
Thank you
very
much
for your help. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. To NURFM, good times and great music and good times with Dennis Stewart today. We're talking health naturally, and we're talking infertility. Now, Dennis, how do herbs work in infertility?
Look, this is a great question. It is fair to say that we don't know exactly how they work. Now, this is a problem for herbal medicine generally. We live at a time when we necessarily expect that everything that we talk about has an adequate a scientific basis to it. A lot of things that we take for granted as being proven don't yield their secrets that easily. And I would put it to the mainstream people there that there are a lot of things about many pharmaceuticals that, in my opinion, don't easily lead to an explanation of how they work. When we come to some herbs, there is what I would consider to be an emerging acceptable understanding of how they work. But I'm the first to admit that herbal medicine is still largely based on what we call empiricism, that is tradition, and traditional use that has been passed on down the ages. With reference to the herbs that form what I would call the backbone of the Western herbal medicine approach to treating infertility, at least three of those herbs, colloquially known as false unicorn root, true unicorn root, and wild yam, at least three of the main fertility herbs, without which I would not be able to treat infertility, those three herbs are all of American origin and owe their reputation and usage to a long history of use by the indigenous people of North America, what we used to refer to as the Red Indian people. Indigenous people these days is perhaps a more politically correct term. But they had a vast history of using herbs which the early settlers picked up on when they went to the US. Fascinating history, by the way, for anyone that wants to look at it. The taking up of indigenous healing information by the early people that went, particularly from the UK. We're talking about the Quakers, the Society of Friends that left the United Kingdom, sailed from Plymouth and set up an early settler population. A capital today, of course, is known as Quakertown. And they were very gracious people that were not cruel, did not land with muskets and arrogance as some other settlers did. Because of their belief structure, they were pacifists, very simple and gentle people, and had a great deal of affinity with the indigenous population. Hence, the indigenous population shared with them a lot of their healing knowledge. Now, what I'm saying here is some of that herbal knowledge had to do with female reproductive problems, and the way in which we still prescribe the herbs that I've just mentioned, false unicorn root, true unicorn root, and wild yam, let me quickly say, all of which have a botanical name, which I'll not bore listeners with, by using those, we have acknowledged the benefit that the tradition, empiricism, that is the use of these herbs in a proven way by an indigenous population, that justifies adequately, in my view, the legitimacy of using these herbs in the treating of infertility. Quite apart from the benefit that they have demonstrated, their history as being the medicine of a very, very, what I would call culturally advanced civilization, the taking up, the listening to them, the usage of the herbs of that population to address female reproductive problems validates the claim for their use today. However, from a Western scientific perspective, some of the explanation would be this, that in some of the herbs that are used in modern Western herbal medicine, despite their traditional basis, which, as I've said, is very respectable and which I give great credit to and respect to, there seems to be constituents which are emerging that have some hormonal characteristics. In the three herbs that I've mentioned today, there is a constituent known as diosgenin. Now, I mentioned that to pharmacists, doctors, pharmacognosists, others. By the way, an excellent work on that has been written by one of my graduate students who also became a PhD from this university. That is Dr. Andrew Pengelly. Diosgenin has an affinity for what we call some of the receptor sites that the female hormones have to target in order to be able to precipitate a pregnancy. So the theory is this, that the constituent diosgenin, popularly found in the fertility-inducing herbs, may have an ability to occupy the same trigger factors in the female reproductive system that some of the female hormones themselves have a capacity to do, but for some reason are not doing it adequately. So we call it, if you like, the possibility of constituents such as diosgenin having, if you like, not a competitive but an augmenting effect on the female reproductive chemistry. Is that an adequate explanation? Probably not. Where do I tend to veer? As I get older, I respect more and more the great traditions associated with herbal medicine, and which I hope and pray the arrogance of the Western mind will not relegate to something insignificant. In the history of medicine, it is profound. And as we get more humble, perhaps, it may be that some of that humility regarding the respect for traditional indigenous medicine might ground itself more in the popular practice of medicine in Western countries such as Australia.
Well, did you speak about those herbs last week, the unicorn?
I may have mentioned their name, but because they need to be mentioned. The three herbs, true and false unicorn root and the herb wild yam. There are other herbs that I may talk about briefly if we get time next week that augment those herbs under certain conditions. But anyone that has utilised my formula, and there are many people that have done so, many successfully, will knowingly or unknowingly have been administered in a liquid form in the specific proportions required, those three traditional remedies from the North American continent. And without them, I would say that I would not have been able to achieve many of the results that have been validated in the usefulness of using herbal medicine to treat a common distressing condition. There would be many listeners out here, and I say this very humbly, that probably listen to this program because of the benefit obtained from listening to the program, utilizing the formulas that I talk about, and have subsequently fallen pregnant. There we go.
Well,
interesting.
You've said it. We heard it here.
Well, yes. Look, it's been a little bit technical today, but I don't think too technical. And I wanted to take up A, the herbs, and B, the methodology, traditional and emerging scientific support for the use, particularly of the wonderful American spectrum.
Well, we'll get to it more next week, I guess.
We certainly will do, Amanda.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. Take care.